Open public input. Oh, boy, we get to hear from you. Okay, the rules are that we call up two individuals at a time, and we'd like you to sit in front of a mic. You don't have to speak too closely to the mic, but we give you each 3 minutes. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we'd like you, if you are in mid-sentence, to conclude your remarks and really wrap it up. So first two people, Mark Green and Carolyn Krausen, would you come forward, please? Okay, Mr. Green, welcome.
Morning. My name is Mark Green. I've been a recreational prospector for over 10 years. I belong to the Lost Dutchman's Mining Association, and I'm an outing director for the Western Washington GPAA chapter near Gig Harbor. I would like to invite all the members of the board to come out to one of our outings and see what we really do when we are out there prospecting and how we protect the environment and how we make the rivers and stuff better for the habitats for the fish. I teach, and Carolyn teaches classes at Washington Middle School. We've done some classes down in the Nisqually area at this facility they have down there. And we teach young people about the rules, about prospecting, how we protect the environment, and how we clean the environment up. We were when we're dredging, you can see the fish come up to the nozzles of the suction hose and actually get the food that we're disturbing in the water to bring it up to them. During the dry seasons, when the water is low, there's depressions in the river that the fish can take refuge in when the water is very low. Also, by the material that comes out the end of the dredge, we're giving the fish a better place to lay their eggs and spawn. We're also taking all the heavy metals out, like lead, mercury, and anything else that may be hurting the environment. And the other part of prospecting with metal detecting, we're picking up the trash along the rivers and all that. As club members, we inform all the new people of the rules and regulations, and we try to enforce them, like when we do our beach mining and out there, that people are filling in their holes and they're not hurting the environment. And again, we'd like to invite you all out there to see what we're doing, so when you are making your rules, you'd be a little bit more informed than just looking at the science of it and not actually seeing what's actually happening.
Thank you. Commissioner Smith?
Could you let us know or some way when you have outings? I know the summer one that you get together in August.
Right, August up north.
And I'm not able to make that, but if there's other ones during the year, I would like to come out.
No, during the rest of the year, most of the places we can only do like high banking, where the dredging, you know, the period of the windows that you have for working in the rivers are very, very short times, like 30 days at the most. And a lot of times, as I say, because we can see that the fish aren't being hurt when they're coming right up to the nozzles. But the websites for all the clubs, like Bedrock, the Washington GPAA, they all have websites and they have all the outings listed on those. But I can make sure that you get a list.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Green. Patty Carter, I'm sorry. Would you come forward?
Oh, I was with Mr. Green, but that's okay.
There is a mic in front of you. Oh, no. I'm sorry. To explain, I just call up the next person so they can come and sit. I'm not neglecting you. I wasn't over... Ms. Okay. Krausen, it's your turn.
Thank you very much. Mark covered most of it. We've been doing this, particularly since they opened the beach mining here, we've been really thorough beach miners, and we spend sometimes 10 days a month out at Cape Disappointment State Park. And we do a lot to everybody that's interested in beach mining. We let them know that they have to be permitted. We go up to people that haven't filled in their holes and tell them to fill in their holes at night so people don't fall in. We let the state parks know that we're the outing director, and if anybody has questions, to come and talk to us and make sure that everybody knows what the rules are. And we use that book that was developed in all of our trainings. You know, we pretty much have it memorized, and people come up to us on the beach all the time, and we tell them every rule, and we work with the people who are down there clamming. They come up to the other part of the beach to work with us. That's why it's really a very good news story for our state, and we really want to improve the communication, because there's some feeling that our club gave input to some of those white papers and it wasn't listened to. And I just got an email about that, and Mark and I weren't involved in it, but we just need to keep that dialogue going, because it's a wonderful hobby. It fits in nicely with the other things Fish and Wildlife does, and we're certainly enjoying it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Haley Shaw, would you just come forward? Hey, Ms. Carter.
Haley and I will be kind of doing ours together.
Okay.
She's a student.
Well, as long as you take 3 minutes each.
Yes.
Good.
Okay. I'm Patty Carter. I'm from Puyallup. Some of you probably recognize my face from last year. I'm a founding director of the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation. We left a little package for all of you to look at, a few pictures, and just we're here with more good news. Man, what a day. This is wonderful. The Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation would like to take a moment to express our appreciation of the major part you guys and Fish and Wildlife played in regard to the Puyallup Hatchery last year. To update you briefly, the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation was created in July of 2012 after the state decided to keep the hatchery. It's been 15 months. We've received our 501c3 from the IRS, and we have our MOU with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. In addition, we helped put the 1949 hatchery on both the state and national historic registries. We've been busy. We're run by volunteers with donations and memberships only. We have purchased over $5,000 in nets for the rotted nets that were there on the round ponds. We spread over 70 ton of gravel in front of to cover the potholes in front of the main building. And now we are creating an educational center, thanks to Department of Fish and Wildlife letting us use the duplex on site. It will have displays, a short video presentation to learn about watershed issues and the life cycle of trout and salmon. A conference room is also being created for meetings or perhaps projects for children. In addition, the remodeling that we're doing is going to provide a much-needed ADA-compliant public bathroom for folks that visit. It will be a great addition to the Puyallup Hatchery when we finish, and we're close. We're getting there. But most importantly, though, with hundreds of people visiting every month, children and adults alike, lives are being touched and transformed. And I brought Haley with us today. She's 17, and she wants to share her story.
Go ahead. Good morning, everybody.
Could you bring the mic a little bit closer?
All right, I'll just yell. my name is Haley Shaw. I'm a Puyallup resident. I'm born and raised in Puyallup. I'm a Running Start student at Pierce College in Puyallup, and I'm also in high school, so in college at the same time. My future goal is to secure a career involving fish and wildlife, and I've been taking courses to further my education towards a career in that field. For as long as I can remember, I have been taking walks at the park and at the hatchery with my family. I've always enjoyed fish. My mom was actually a fishmonger for 11 years, so fish is in my family. Recently, I have begun volunteering at the Puyallup Hatchery, and now I have the opportunity to see what the more important sides of the hatchery besides just the outsides. But learning a lot from everybody there, and it's been great, and it's really inspired me to further go for a career in fish and wildlife. In coming here this morning, I just wanted to say thank you for everything you guys have done for the Puyallup Hatchery and all the support that you guys have given us. Thank you.
Lastly.
Good for you.
Lastly, I'd like to mention just a few of our supporters. The Muckleshoot Tribe has given us $10,000.
for our efforts. Lowe's has donated $2,500 in supplies, but more important, they've had volunteer groups that have come down and helped with the seeding, and they're going to do that with our landscaping out front. Corliss Sand and Gravel stepped up and gave us that gift of gravel out front. And Coram Automotive Group in Puyallup saw this as a very worthy cause and have donated $2,500. Aside from money and volunteers, more interest in our hatchery is being attracted, and we see that all the time, especially when we're out talking to folks. We have some folks coming from NOAA in a couple of weeks. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that organization. They see perhaps a partnership in education. Who knows? We have 80 acres. We could have a science lab. We could have a weather station. I just know if people come together for a good cause, especially for the future of our planet and our kids, they load up their pocket with dreams and ambition. Anything is possible. So thank you, commissioners. Thank you, Department of Fish and Wildlife. Your decision to keep the Puyallup Fish Hatchery was the right one. And the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation will be committed to its future. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Anderson, before you depart.
This is just a fantastic example of what can happen with a public-private partnership. And you all, Patty and Haley and everybody involved, are really to be commended. We're proud to be in this partnership with you, and I think it's going to pay great dividends that extend far beyond just the raising of the fish that are there. So thank you so much.
You're a future employee here.
Yeah, I want to make sure we...
She'll be sitting in one of your seats.
Yeah, we welcome that, definitely. Thank you so much. Okay, Bob Mulhauser and Ed Tharp, would you come forward?
Morning.
I'm here to talk about last year's issue on the closure of the Seven Gills shark. Those sharks are travelers. They fish for them in other states, and you folks closed it. And taken the Quinault Nation, kill some of those sharks, and we can't. And those sharks, those females produce over 50 pups, and I cannot see any justification why you folks closed it. And then you went and revisit the issue. And then you took and made it so that guide down on the Willapa can still guide for him, and I can't go fishing for him. But yet, if I pay him $300 or $400 his fee, I can go on his boat, and that is not right. And I have no problem with him doing research, but to have to pay to go fishing for him, and he gets to fish for him, he gets paid for it, and I can't go out. And I can't tell you how disappointed my grandson was. He started fishing, and he went out shark fishing. That boy never talks at all. And when somebody talked to us about the sharks, he just lit up. He talked. He was excited. And then I had to tell him I couldn't take him fishing for him anymore. That is wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Mr. Tharp, would Robert Rao please come forward? Okay, Mr. Tharp.
I'm Ed Tharp, and I do a lot of fishing. And I have a lot of fly fishermen know that I go to some of these, normally the North Falcon meeting, but occasionally if I can, try to come to a commission meeting. But they want to add a tenkari fly fishing in with the regular fly fishing. The only difference between the two is on the tenkari, you're using a rod that's 11 to 14 foot long. It's an extension rod, and it folds back up, but you tie the line to the end of the pole. So you're not using a rod. You're using a rod, but you're not using the reel. And there's a specified, on the regular tenkari, the specified rules, regulations on what your line is. And it's normally a woven line, but you're only using line from 10 and a half to 13 foot long. And fly fishing regs say a 20, at least a 25-foot fly line. But they would like to have it added in so they could use the Tenkari method. Because what it is, normally it's just like a pitch, like our old way we used to fish for whitefish with the cane pole with the line tied on the end of it, or your old willow switch. But there's a lot of rules and regulations on it, on the Tenkari. It's upkeen pages if you start going through the computer on it. So what they want to do is try to add it. Have that Tenkari added in on the deal. I'll give you my little brief card.
Okay. Commissioner Smitten?
After 43 years of fish business, I thought I knew a little bit of everything. I don't know what you're really talking about. Is this for tuna or salmon?
This is for trout. You can even use it for salmon, too, if you really play it good. They use it in England, Japan. This is where Japan is where it started. England, they call it another type of a fishing, but it's more of a technique than, and you got to be a lot gentler with the fish.
And you say they're proposing regulations or changes. Who are the they?
Well, they would like to have it added in for the fly fishing only waters.
I got it now.
Because see, they can't use it in the fly fishing only because of the way the reg is written up.
Thank you.
Interesting subject. Thank you. And you can give your card to Tammy.
Yeah.
Okay. Bruce Furke. Furke. I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Sorry, Mr. Rao.
Yes, I'm here to speak. I'm from Alma, Washington, and I won't be able to attend tomorrow's meeting, which is why I'm here today. And my wife and I have both attended numerous meetings on the Grays Harbor Salmon Management Plan. We moved to Alma 10 or 11 years ago. I've been a resident of Washington for almost 40 years and have fished here in all that time. When we moved to the Alma Grays Harbor area, we noticed that some of our neighbors on our street alone, within four houses of us, had small boats, and they would go to the Chehalis River and fish for salmon. And none of them were very forthcoming in information. We had to kind of suck it out of them. But we, 3 years ago, we became ardent anglers in the Chehalis River for salmon. Our first 2 years were pretty good. I think last year we had 15 fish. We didn't catch any kings we could keep. We had to release kings 2 or 3 days before the season for them opened in the upper river, but we still caught enough fish to feed us and put fish into our freezer and into our smoker. What we realized then was that the family values aspect of sport fishing in Grays Harbor has a long history, and a lot of our neighbors that had been doing it weren't doing it like they used to. They weren't going out very much. And when we asked why, they said, there aren't enough fish in the river, or we're not allowed to fish for king. Well, we've been looking into this, and one of the biggest problems that we have is that we have an outdated commercial fishing in Grays Harbor that has no business being there. It really doesn't. Most of the fishermen that do it, it's supplemental income to them. We have a tribal fishery in the same area that more than adequately supplies our local supermarkets and restaurant needs for salmon. The runs there are obviously threatened. The management has just really lost the ball in this whole scheme. I spoke to probably 100 to 200 fishermen on the water this year, and most of them were catching 10 or 15% of what they had caught the year before or in previous years. You added 2 weeks onto our season at the beginning of the September, and when there weren't any fish in the river. So by October 1st, when the commercial and the tribal fishermen had really started to put their nets in, there wasn't anything left in the river. There wasn't anything coming up into the river. The netting schedules are atrocious for local people. Economically, each fish that commercial people catch represents about 20% at the most of what that fish represents to the economy on a sport basis. And this figure has been ignored when you look at the impact to Grays Harbor, where I would count 40 or 50 cars in the parking lots in Aberdeen, Montesano, and along the river. This year, there was maybe 10 or 15% of that. And I spoke to a lot of fishermen, and they were all of the same mind, that we've given up a lot in terms of Chinook runs. We've given up a lot in terms of trying to conserve. But the state obviously feels that the commercial interests outweigh the conservation interests. And that's plain wrong. And my wife and I are going to attend these meetings more, and we're going to watch for the transparency that people on this commission have spoke of, which hasn't been very evident in the past. We had meetings where, at the last minute, North of Falcone rules were changed by people from this commission at the last minute to favor commercial people. That's wrong. Until we can control observers on every commercial boat, we shouldn't allow those commercial boats to go out, because they obviously are not using their units for reviving the fish. That's evident in the videos put out by fishingthechehalis.com. You can look at those videos and you can see that those boxes aren't being used. And we don't have the people to put on them. So let's save the resource and limit commercial fishing to other areas where it hasn't decimated the runs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rao. Mr. Furkey, is that right?
October 31st, that was last Thursday, actually, I met with three fisheries biologists up on the North Fork of the Skykomish River. And they were going to look at the area to see if there was any possibility for granting small-scale mining or dredging outside the windows that were given to us, which amounts to about 1 month out of the year. So we walked up and down the stream and looked at things, and the lead biologist said that, yes, there is spawning habitat here on the ground that you want to work. So basically, that could be the end of the story. Whether it's based on the Endangered Species Act or what, I don't know, but it was sort of in the window where salmon were running up there. We didn't see any salmon. We also saw moss on the bottom of the stream. There was kind of a question about that. Well, what's that due to? Is it water temperature or what? And then also there was a comment about a study was done on how many reds were in the North Fork up there. Well, a helicopter was taken up there at a certain time during the window when salmon were supposed to be spawning, and there was only 2 to 3 reds spotted several miles downstream from this area that I wanted to work. I've been kind of directed to say that in the new rulemaking for windows, for the activity that we like to do in the water, and there should be science backing up the rulemaking. If there's no fish spawning there, then we should be able to continue with what we like to do. If there's a shortage of money, maybe, well, look at the universities, maybe, for people who like to do studies to help you guys out. There's grants available. And again, we maintain no science, no rulemaking. Rulemaking should be based on science, not just public, not just personal opinion. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. That concludes the open public input morning item.